on through its doors, just as if it seems to know I'm exclusively yours. Knowing this, I feel but one way. You will understand it too, in these words that I say. I'll close my eyes to everyone but you, and when I do, I'll see you standing there. I'll lock my heart to any other caress. I'll never say yes to a new love affair. Gay. If you are not there, to share each lovely day, and through the years, and those moments when we're far apart. Don't you know I'll close my eyes, and I'll see you with my heart.
Expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents.
And hello and welcome again to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM. KUCI, we are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're also on the web at kuci.org, and we podcast at writersonwriting.blogspot.com. So this show, and so many of my shows, should be up there. If not right now, soon. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And today my guests are Bill Contardi and Lolly Winston. My first guest is Bill Contardi. For 10 years, Bill was an editor with New American Library. He then worked with United Artists and Warner Brothers as the VP Literary Affairs, the liaison between the studios and the publishing communities. For 11 years, Bill was dramatics rights agent for books at William Morris Agency in New York, selling books to film and television. For the past 4 years, he has been a literary agent at Brandt and Hockman Literary Agents, developing new writers of fiction and nonfiction. Bill also does some dramatic rights for books representation. And yesterday he closed a deal for Brad Pitt's company, Plan B, to option The Double Life of Alice B. Sheldon for development as a feature film. Hi, Bill. How are you?
Okay. How are you?
Good. Great to have you on. I was going to ask you how you found your way into agenting and... And then, of course, your bio. You were an editor.
Yeah, I've been in various capacities in this business for a long time. I started out. I actually started out just to get my foot in the door, working on a trade magazine for the paper industry, And then I had an opportunity to move from that after a couple of years over to New American Library working in production. I didn't have any secretarial skills, and at the time it was important in order to train or mentor, be mentored by an editor at the time, it would be, you know, important to have the ability to type. So I got in through through production, but actually that turned out to be a good thing because I got to learn about the business, that end of the business, and then eventually worked my way into editorial, first in sort of academic books. At the time, it was the Mentor line of books, Mentor and Plume at New American Library. And then I was moved over to the mass market line of paperback called Signet. So this was the 70s, and paperback was in full swing then. And it was a pretty exciting time in publishing, especially in that end of the business. We did reprints from hardcover, and we did originals. It was a great opportunity for young people because you could move up the ranks, oftentimes by jumping from company to company, but there was always a company to go to. Mm-hmm. And it was a real sense of community and camaraderie. And it was great. And a lot of those people are still in the business in various capacities. A number of them have moved on and left New York. But it really, 30 years later, you know, I've gone through several incarnations or different kinds of jobs, but all related to books. And, you know, there are still people around who I do business with and who I see socially and professionally who go back to that period.
Yeah. Yeah, so what's your favorite thing to be doing as an agent? Is there like one thing that goes on that you do that you love more than anything, or is it the mix of various things that you do?
Well, I mean, it seems the book agenting, literary agenting, which is what I've been doing for the past 4 years, coming up to my fifth year, I've been working at a small agency called Branton Hockman. And all of the various things I did before, from being an editor to working in the film business, seeing how they address books and what books work for that market, and then coming over to this end of the business, selling books to publishing. It all seems to have been organic, although there was no master plan, as you can imagine. I mean, but it all seemed to, in retrospect, really grow nicely out of each other, just seizing opportunities to learn and to hopefully make the best of the situation. And what I like about this now is being close to the author end of it. I mean, when I was selling books to film, I was representing, as a dramatic rights agent, I would represent literary agents, or sometimes I would represent the publisher who had the film rights in brokering the deal with the film people or the TV people. So I was one step removed from the author and from the creation of the book. And you know, with agenting, with literary agenting, I the good news and the bad news is there's a lot of hands-on work with the development of the manuscript. The market being so tough, you can't go out with anything that, you know, that isn't almost ready to go to the printer. I mean, that's a little bit of an exaggeration, but it has to be really clean. There's no second chance, and you really have to work with the author to try to get the best possible draft before you bring it to the editors.
You know, something that seems to depress a lot of writers these days is the aspect of marketing and how, if you're writing nonfiction, and even to a certain extent probably fiction, you need to have some sort of visibility, some sort of platform. And I think more and more writers are feeling, why can't we just write and leave the promotion to the publishers?
Yeah, that would be great for all of us if that was the case. And it might have been more the case years ago, but it seems to me that it's gotten to be less and less. They will, you know, do promotion, but their lists are so expensive that they don't have the resources that they might have had before to properly promote. Unless it's something that's showing life, but it's, you know, like a situation that it doesn't show life sometimes, unless you get behind it.
Yeah.
But it's very important to publishers these days, and therefore to agents, that there be some kind of profile the author has, you know, to be general. But I guess you would say, you know, that there's the dread word platform. But with regard to fiction, as an agent on the front lines, you know, the first entry point to an agent is the query, and I look to see if it's fiction, what the author has written before. But that doesn't necessarily have to have been a book. I mean, first novels are really what I'm kind of like specializing in now, because it's I'm trying to build a list, and it takes, in the best of times, 5 years to do that. I've been 4 years at it, and I'm starting to see things start to come together. But I look for an author to tell me something about themselves that makes me feel that they have a real bug for writing. You know, I mean, it might be just that they write for their local newspaper, or that they, you know, have published poems in their high school yearbook. That's a little bit of a overstatement or dramatization there, but something that tells me that they really have a burning desire, and it's not just, you know, it's not just I've retired from my job after 35 years and I'm doing what I really want to do now. You know, it's like, it's really helpful to have something, I think, that gives them a profile. And that profile, as I said, could be what I just, you know, mentioned, from the most humble kind of writing credits to, you know, contributing to a literary magazine, to, you know, to being a journalist. Anything that says that they know the discipline, or they know how to produce something, you know, on the page. It also is helpful in terms of getting noticed by an agent. I think if they have something in their background, like an MFA, or they've studied writing, that's always helpful. And maybe other writers that have read their work, or that they've worked with, who they can cite. It's just that there's such a volume that comes our way as agents, a volume of people that want to be noticed,
yes,
and to be read, that you to maintain your sanity and to have any kind of a life, you have to be able to quickly be able to select what you're going to spend any time with.
Mm.
And that selection process, in my case, oftentimes begins with looking not at the story synopsis first, but really at who the writer is.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be Joe Bagot Nunes, it can be somebody unknown, but
sure.
But something there that just kind of sparks. It shows that they have a real passion for writing.
You are listening to Writers on Writing. I am with New York City literary agent Bill Contardi. What about, do you find journalists crossing over into fiction? Someone who, say, has published, I don't know, narrative nonfiction or some other sort of nonfiction, and is submitting to you chapters or even a query for a novel manuscript. What is your reaction to that? And does it happen much?
Well, again, you know, just to preface my particular situation, I'm coming to this after, you know, I mean, I'm in some ways an old pro or something like that, having been in the business for over 30 years, but only the past 4 years and 4.5 years of developing a list as a literary agent. So I speak from that background, but my feeling is that there's such an interest in nonfiction these days, and there's such a blurring of the lines between fiction and nonfiction, that I welcome journalists coming, you know, forward with their ideas for novels, and you know, the truth issues aside, I think it can be sometimes pretty exciting, the stuff that can come from them. Although, you know, I'm working now with a journalist from a very prestigious newspaper who's, you know, just been working in the sports area, and I'm having to take him through several drafts of a novel, his first novel. There's an understandable kind of tendency to expect, as a journalist, that somebody's going to maybe pick up after you. I mean, you put out the the copy, and then somebody's going to clean it up. But that's not the way it works. Writing a book, you really have to you have to polish it, revise it, and sure, an agent will help, but you can't do in the line, hands on, you know, page by page for everything. So you really want that writer to be able to know that when you're doing a book, it's different from delivering, you know, a story to the newspaper and having somebody there kind of clean it up.
Mm. So what kind of fiction excites you? What do you see come in the door and you go, yes, this is it?
Well, as we speak, I'm going out through the marvelous technology of email to editors with a novel that I was very excited about when I read this summer, and with little changes, it's ready to go. And it's a big, sweeping epic that is a sort of, it's set in Paris and in the Middle East, and from 1921 to maybe the mid-20s and a little bit back to World War I. And it's a very exciting kind of picture of a particular time and place with great vision for the history of that time, but really careful attention to the details and the characterization. You have in the foreground, you have a character who's having who's got something he's trying to unravel, a mystery that happened to him as an officer in that war in the Middle East. On the Middle Eastern front, it's called Mesopotamia, but you don't know what it is, and you're gradually learning in the course of this long story. But he's also having relationships, he's having friendships, he's having love affairs, and the history that comes in, the real characters blended with the fictional characters. There's Churchill, there's Lawrence of Arabia, and you really, this is a bit of a blending of fiction and history and fiction, and I came away from it feeling I understand current events a little bit better. Because we're so much absorbed by what's going on in Iraq at this point and that part of the world, to read a book that talks about how the world was actually carved up to what it is now 100 years ago, that's part of the story. World War I is when it all kind of, these places that were considered Mesopotamia and then went on to become Iraq and Syria and mm-hmm. Israel and Palestine mm-hmm. and Turkey, that's what they were originally as Mesopotamia. So it's that really exciting, because I learned something, you know, and also I was swept up into a world that I didn't know that much about, but enough to really interest me and want to know more.
Yeah. I'm talking with literary agent Bill Contardi, and we have a few minutes left. Is the state of literary fiction as dire as some of the reports are making it sound?
I don't think it's dire. The agency I work for, we really do specialize in literary fiction. I mean, we also need to make a buck, but my experience is that editors, the door opens if the writing is really good. So if literary fiction means good writing, then I think that there's definitely a receptivity to literary fiction. It's then beyond the good writing, it's got to be, you know, a good story that has some commercial angle for them. But it's very exciting, I think, for agents like myself, but also for editors to find new voices that and writing that is really first rate. That's, I think, that there is a market for good writing.
Someone emailed me today and said that she'd been getting back to writing, and she said, so how do you find an agent? And I said, very curtly, and didn't know what to say because it seems like such a big topic, but I said, really great query letter, really great writing, and a story that an agent wants, is compelled to read and to sell mm-hmm. for you. But what would you say to that?
Well, what I say to writers who come forward with emails, inquiring about their book and whether I'd be interested, and if I'm not interested or if it doesn't seem right for me, I will say to them, that they should look in the acknowledgement section of any books that they really admire and that they would like their particular piece to be compared to. And in those acknowledgements, usually the author will thank, besides the editor, they'll thank their agent. And that agent would be one of the people that they should consider going to with their work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And I think, you know, having a good query letter, but you don't want to smother, you don't want to like do a widely scattered kind of submission to many agents. That, you know, be tactical and be careful and go to those people that you think are right. One of the biggest turnoffs and absolute, you know, immediate like pass is to get a query that is to about, you know, to a cluster of agents. And people do it, and I just don't understand why they think that would be the way to proceed. It's just so counterintuitive.
Yes. Well, yeah, it's sort of like, you know, getting something in the mail that says, "Dear occupant."
Yeah. No, it's got to, they've got to be as thoughtful in how they approach this, they being the writer, as the, you know, as an agent has to be when they try to sell what they're representing. They have to find the right editor for the material, the right match, and that's really important.
So how do you like to be contacted? Do you like snail mail? Do you like email? What works best for you?
What works best for me is email. And it's a very quick turnaround, but when it's snail mail and I don't have access to an email to respond, it's harder to, to respond quickly with my feelings. So I think email is a very helpful tool. Not phone calls, though.
Yeah, not phone calls. Well, because it's about the writing anyway. It's not about how charming or interesting you are on the phone. It's you, the writer.
Well, it's also about, you know, we all lead such crazy busy lives, and as the business has pared down and become less, there are less frills, there are fewer assistants, you know, and so people do their own thing here, you don't want to be fielding phone calls from everybody else in the normal course of the day that you have to deal with, like editors and such, and then have cold calls from authors. They're not going to get the attention that they deserve that way. If, you know, an agent will take the time to read an email when he or she has that moment to give it a fair, you know, evaluation. But if you're just calling cold, it could be in the middle of some crisis, and that author's not going to get a fair shake.
Sure. And in closing, I wonder if you would say a few words about how to deal with rejection, and especially if you're sending something out and it continues to be rejected by agents. How many times should you, you know, how many letters should you get before you decide a major revision is necessary, and how persevering should you be? Because this is something I think all writers, when they start sending out their work, are dealing with, and they don't quite know how to interpret rejection letters.
I think, I try to be helpful in as much as I can with at least something in my response that is more specific than not right for me. I mean, if I'm, I think. Oh, wait a minute. No, maybe I'm confusing this. I'm talking about my response on something I've read. If it's a, and I think that's what you've got to mean, because if they're going to revise, it has to be a piece of material that the agent has passed on. Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, I would say strike a balance between being very persevering and not too thin-skinned, and strike a balance between that and just being open to what you're hearing. And if you're hearing considered and thoughtful feedback and not just some kind of like automatic, you know, response, listen to it and see if you might get some consistent thoughts along the same lines. And if that's the case, then I would seriously consider revising it, because you know, a good agent will give some kind of feedback that even if they don't want to see it again, they're going to say something that might be helpful for that author to consider addressing when they go out to a new batch of people. Yeah. So I'd say they could have, as writers, a good opportunity to get some feedback to make their piece work better from those reject letters.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for taking the time.
My pleasure.
I should tell everyone that you were at the ASJA conference last April, and if you want to hear more from Bill Contardi, go to the ASJA.org website, and on that website, go to tapes, CDs for sale. And there is one called Making Books into Movies. And you were quite informative and interesting on that panel. And you have a whole lot to say about a topic we haven't even touched on.
Thank
you so much.
Oh, my pleasure.
That was Bill Contardi talking to us from New York City. Again, he's with Branton Hockman in New York. And if you want to know more, about how to find him, you could look in the book called Literary Agents, published by Writers Digest Books, Writers Market. I don't know. I think it's Writers Digest Books. Sorry. The 2007 edition. I have an article in there, actually, too, Dealing with Denial, something like that. It's about rejection, dealing with rejection from agents and in publishing. And I believe it's on the newsstand or in the bookstore now. And it's, you know, lots of agents in that book. And look for agents that do not charge fees. You don't want an agent who's going to charge you to look at your work. So much to say on the topic. Right now, though, we need to take a short break. So stay with us when we come back. Hopefully we will be with Lolly Winston. So don't go anywhere.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Of sound bites and constant visual stimulation telling us how to look, act, talk, and feel, we have lost our ability to connect. Instead of focusing on what celebrities are doing as if they were our acquaintances, maybe we can look more to each other to emulate and learn from. Join us Friday mornings from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. with Peace by Peace, where we discuss issues that affect our peace, peace of humanity, and peace in our time.
Weekly Signals, every Tuesday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. Join me, Mike Casper, and Nathan Callahan for the best in reality-based radio. That's Weekly Signals. Check out the website at weeklysignals.com.
Darling, you say you want to write a book? Well, then you must listen to Writers on Writing, darling. Authors, literary agents gabbing and babbling about the art and the business of writing. Thursdays, 5 p.m. Darling, you must. Barbara DeMarco Barrett, she hosts. Yeah, listen, darling.
On KCI-FM in Irvine.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and you are listening to 88.9 FM KUCI, broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're also streaming live on the web at kuci.org, and we have a podcast happening at writersonwriting.blogspot.com, where you can listen to past shows. This show will be up there in a week or so, so tune in to, visit the blog. Visit my website, penonfire.com, and you can hook on to the iTunes podcast there, too. I want to tell you about the songs that were played, because I'm getting a lot of emails these days about the songs that I play. And the first one is Dinah Washington, I'll Close My Eyes. And the second one is Come Back Baby by Brian Barrett. And that one is not for sale yet, but if you email me at penonfire@earthlink.net, I will give you more information about it. And we are here with Lolly Winston. She's the New York Times bestselling author of Good Grief. Her work has appeared in Redbook, Glamour, Lifetime, Family Circle, The Sun, and so many other publications. She lives in Northern California. And today we're going to talk about Happiness Sold Separately, published by Warner Books. Hi, Lolly.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here, and I want to say I appreciate you. I know you're on your way to San Francisco, and you're on your cell phone, and so we might be dealing with some background sounds, and it's just great to have you on. And,
oh, great.
I love your book.
You might hear a car, but just so you know, I'm not driving and talking. I am pulled over.
What freeway are you on?
Pardon me?
What freeway are you on?
I'm in Glen Park on Chenery Street.
Oh, well, I'm glad you're here, and I love Happiness Sold Separately. I love.
Oh, thank you.
I loved Good Grief, and I couldn't wait for your next book to come out. And Happiness.
I know that feeling. I feel that way about authors.
Well, yeah, you know, it's some authors just don't publish quickly enough, and I loved Happiness Sold Separately, and really didn't want this book to end. I love so much about it, and I wonder if you could just talk for a few minutes about how the book came about. What was the genesis for this idea?
Well, I guess it came from sort of a premise. I wanted to write a messy love story about a couple, one of whom has an affair, but I wanted each of the three parties in the love triangle, sounds sort of like a soap opera, but for each of them to be redeemed. I feel like in a lot of those kinds of stories, somebody, in order to redeem one character, the other one or two has to be a real jerk. And I wanted everyone to be sort of a lot of gray area with no good guys or bad guys. And I guess when I think of the classic story, particularly of women having affairs, they always seem to be punished in the end. You know, Anna Karenina goes under the train and Madame Bovary goes down in flames. And I wanted to have a sort of more true to contemporary life, messy love triangle story, I guess.
Yeah. I love how in the very beginning of the book, the husband is having an affair, and the way that Eleanor catches him in the affair, it was really kind of a unique twist and not your usual thing, not what you would expect. And I think also just the humor that you bring to the book is really just wonderful.
Well, I think a lot of topics are, it's easy to fall into the area of melodrama, especially, you know, an affair. It sounds so General Hospital. But I think if you look for the humor in those dark moments, that's where you hopefully come up with poignancy.
Now, before you started this book, did you do any outlining or any plotting, or how did you, or did you just start and see where it was going to go?
Usually I start with sort of a premise or a theme, and then a character and a voice. And I probably spend way too much on that first chapter because I really want to nail down the voice. And in this case, it was the voice of Eleanor, the wife. And this was told from several different points of view. But I start with Eleanor, and then I write a few chapters, and then I realize, ooh, I kind of need a narrative arc. Maybe I ought to sit down and see where this is all going. And then I start to sort of sketch out a bit of a plot in sort of Aristotle's traditional triangle. But I don't have a whole too fancy an outline ahead of time.
So when you sit down to write, say, every day, most days, do you, the day before, do you know where you're going to start the next day? So when you sit down to write, you know what you're doing? Or do you just sit down and brainstorm? Or are you locked in at that point?
I sort of follow Anne Lamott's advice of short assignments, sort of junky first draft. So I write down in my day planner a little assignment for myself. Otherwise, it's so overwhelming, the thought of writing an entire novel. In the past, I've written mostly short stories and essays, and you can hold the template for an essay in your head, and a short story you can sort of hold in your head at some point, although that's more difficult. But a novel, it's overwhelming to sit down and think of where to begin. So I make little assignments for myself. It's kind of goofy, but I guess it comes out of being a feature writer, too, where I would have to figure out what I was going to do the next day, maybe an interview or write the lead paragraph or something. So I usually break it down.
And then you'll work the assignment into the chapter, or is this a nonlinear sort of way of working where you're collecting scenes?
Usually it's whatever I happen to be working on that day, I'll sort of leave off there with what I need to do the next day. In terms of, it could be a chapter, it could be character development. You know, once I'm through a first draft, then there's a long sort of to-do list of improving details and fleshing out characters and spiffing up scenes and better verbs. And, I don't know, I'm sort of obsessive-compulsive list maker, and it's interesting, and it even applies to my writing life, too.
Interesting. You are listening to Writers on Writing, and I am here with Lolly Winston, author of Happiness Sold Separately. I love the title, by the way, as well. And at what point did the title come? Did it come when you had it in the text? Because I found those words in the text.
It came very early on. It was interesting. With Good Grief, I had a finished book and no title, and with Happiness Sold Separately, I had the title very early on and no book. Sort of the opposite. Experience. And I had a two-book contract, and for the second book, I had to sort of tell my publisher what I had in mind, what I was going to be up to, and I had the title and sort of the basic premise. Those were the first things that I had.
That's interesting. So, I mean, two-book contracts are kind of rare these days, don't you think? I mean, that was very wonderful.
Yeah, it is. I think it's wonderful. My agent was very good about explaining to me that there are pros and cons, and the pro is that you know you're going to have work, which as a writer and a freelancer and a starving artist over the years, I went for it just because of that. The year that I was working on the novel and making very little money, you know, was so scary that I opted to have a contract with two books. But I think publishers are offering them now, and the good thing about, it's hard to write under deadline, to write fiction under deadline, I think. But the the good thing about it can be that a publisher is more invested in your first book. If you have a two-book contract, you know, it behooves them to promote your first book. You know, there's pros and cons, and everybody has a different opinion, but I decided to go. It seemed like a good idea at the time to sign that thing.
Now, are there any characters in Happiness Sold Separately that you particularly identify with?
Well, you know, that's interesting. There's the husband and the wife and the lover, the husband's lover, and her son. And I guess I identify with aspects of each of the three main characters. I can identify with Ted, the husband's frustration, just that frustration of wanting to sort of put your fist through a wall when you don't know how to resolve something, particularly an emotional problem. And I could relate to Eleanor's sort of heartbreak with infertility because I went through all those treatments. And for Gina, you know, everyone's had the experience of unrequited love, and I could identify with that. So I tried to tap into each of those qualities because I wanted to redeem each of the characters. I wanted to make each of them sympathetic. I tried to think about the aspects of each of the characters that I could identify to or relate to when I was working on their chapters.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm talking with Lolly Winston, author of Happiness Sold Separately. It's funny, we're talking about your book. For someone who hasn't read it, they might very much think it's a romance novel because, you know, there's this romantic story that is the book, and yet it is so not a romance novel. Do you deal with that at all? I mean, or how would you describe your book? Someone says, well, you know, there's this romantic relationship, then if it's not a romance, what is it?
I guess I describe it as a messy love story, a bittersweet love story. I'm sort of terrible at the Hollywood elevator pitches,
right.
And it's true. It's hard whenever you boil a book down to just sort of a synopsis. You can't help but sound like the TV guide, you know. And I think in the end, the basic storyline of a novel, I mean, you know, Anna Karenina and General Hospital could sound the same if you boiled them all down to the basic storyline. I think a lot of what makes a book great is the telling of the story rather than the story itself. In other words, rather than the actual plot points, I guess.
Yes, yeah.
But it is hard. It's very hard. I mean, don't you? I think for all writers, that's your worst fear at a cocktail party. Oh, you're writing a book. Well, what's it about? And then that's when you want to run and hide behind the cheese tray, I think.
So will you actually try to answer that question, or will you just go, oh, tell me about you?
It was a little bit easier with me for good grief because I sort of came up with an elevator pitch. I said, oh, you know, it's about a woman who's widowed at 36, and instead of going through five stages of grief, she goes through 15. So I had it sort of summed up in a conceptual way. But with Happiness Sold Separately, I just kind of stumble and fumble and mumble and say, oh, it's a messy love story. It's about how hard it is to be married, I guess. And I don't want to give away the ending, too. I mean, I can think of a way to sum it up that gives away the ending that would be more succinct. I don't want to do that.
No.
So.
Well, I wanted to say I really liked the ending so much because it was rather vague, and yet I thought I knew what was going to happen. But it wasn't just so neatly tied up that you just go, okay.
Yeah, I mean, that's the hard thing about writing a novel. You want it to have a narrative arc and that sort of climax and resolution, but you don't want it to be too neatly wrapped up in the end. And I find that, you know, contemporary marriage and relationship is very messy and open-ended. And so I had to work at the ending, at the climax and the resolution. That's probably the hardest part of writing a book for me.
Hmm. One listener from Australia emailed and asked if you would talk about the actual physical layout of how you write, if you write directly into a notebook, or if you write your first drafts on computer, if you're in an office, if you're in a restaurant, if you're in a park.
I have sort of a Rain Man schedule where I write from 9 to 1 in my office, because it's sunny and bright and I seem to have more brain cells in the morning. And in the afternoon, I take a little bit of a break. And then sometimes I do take pages to coffee shops in the afternoon and do hand editing. It's just nice to have a change of scenery. I get tired of my office. And it's also my office is sort of dark and oppressive to me in the afternoons. And I've gone to a couple of readings where authors have said that they will make a break as simple as just taking, moving away from their computer and taking a pad and paper to the dining room table or even just spreading out on a bed. And I thought, ooh, that sounds like a good idea. I'm going to try that too. So I work from about 9 till 1, and then I'll do some hand editing in the afternoon, and I cook dinner every night because my husband commutes, so, and I'm so grateful that I don't have to work in a cubicle, so I do this sort of June Cleaver thing and make dinner every night, and while I'm making dinner, I usually do a little bit of writing, too.
That's a good way of getting writing done, actually, when in between those spots of things like making dinner and things are boiling.
Yeah. The only problem is I do burn things sometimes.
Oh, wow.
The house is still standing, though. So.
We have a few minutes left with Lolly Winston, author of Happiness Sold Separately. And I wanted to ask you about the tense you wrote this in. You wrote this book in first person present tense. I'm sorry, third person present tense. And I'm curious how you chose that, and also different point of view characters. How you came to all that?
Right. Well, my first book was in first person present tense, and with the second book, I was very interested in. The second book is in alternating points of view, but it's third point person limited point of view. And I just grew as a reader. I've always really loved that sort of camera on the character's shoulder point of view, and I felt it really helped me to make the characters sympathetic and really sort of get inside their heads. But I also found that I had to give them a voice too, and think of, for example, Gina never curses and Eleanor does, and Ted is, you know, uses words of more frustration, and a book that I love that's in third person limited point of view with alternating points of view is Case Histories by Kate Atkinson.
Uh-huh.
And when I read that, I was really inspired. I thought, oh, I love this, and what do I love about this book? I love these alternating points of view, so I really wanted to do that. And then, and also, in Good Grief, I found the first-person present tense, it's limiting after a while. It's really becomes kind of hard.
Mm-hmm. And yet Good Grief was done so well, and it seemed fairly seamless.
Well, thanks. You know, it never feels easy as you're doing it. I know every Dorothy Parker said, I hate writing, I love having written. I always feel that way after having finished a book. Yeah.
Any last words or words of advice for the writers listening?
Well, I just think Anne Lamott's book, Bird for Bird, just saved my life as a writer. I love that book so much. And any time I feel like banging my head on my desk or tearing my hair out or that droplets of blood are going to show up on my forehead, I pull that book off the shelf and just flip through it and see that someone who writes that wonderfully is so funny and has such terrific insight into the often infuriating process of writing. I guess that would be. And her, basically, she just says, show up and allow yourself to do, you know, the sort of junky first drafts.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
Short assignments. I think those are the three things.
Well, thanks so much for pulling over and being able to be with us.
Me.
The sound has been great, and continued good luck with this book.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Lolly.
Take care.
That was Lolly Winston, author of Happiness Sold Separately, published by Warner Books. A wonderful book. I absolutely loved it. And I wouldn't say that if I didn't mean it. I like a lot of books, but I love this one. I am going to end a few minutes early. But first, I want to say that if you want to know more about this show, you can go to penonfire.com. Click on the radio tower. It will take you to the radio page. And you will see the schedule, and you'll see how you can connect with the iTunes podcasts and all kinds of stuff. And what else? I'm going to leave you with a quote by Ivy Compton Burnett, who said, "As regards plot, I find real life no help at all. Real life seems to have no plots. And as I think a plot desirable and almost necessary, I have this extra grudge against life." Thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. Next week we have Joe Esterhaus, who is a famous screenwriter, Basic Instinct and Jagged Edge and all sorts of movies. He has a new book out, and we're going to talk about that. He'll be on for the entire hour. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. My book's Pen on Fire, and I'll talk to you soon.